now. Sarah Vaughan is in Philadelphia performing at the Fairmont Hotel. It's 13 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In the mid-60s, the most raunchy and radical band around was the Fugs. They did some songs about drugs and sex and anti-war songs and songs that you can't sing or really talk about on the radio. With me is Thule Kupferberg, one of the members of the Fugs. Thule is also the author of 101 Ways to Live Without Working and Listen to the Mockingbird, satiric songs to tunes that you know. Thule's in Philadelphia with Lani Canfield for a performance of their group, The Revolting Theater. Last night, The Revolting Theater performed as part of the Wooden Shoes discussion and film series. The Wooden Shoe is Philadelphia's anarchist book and record shop on 20th Street. Well, before we meet Thule and Lani, I thought we could listen to one of the selections from one of the Fugs records from the mid-60s. This is a song that you may remember. It's Kill for Peace. Mid-1960s, that was the group The Fugs. Recording was Kill for Peace. My guest is Thule Kupferberg, who was with The Fugs at that time, and also Lannis Canfield. And together they form the Revolting Theater, which performed in Philadelphia last night. I'd like to welcome you both to Fresh Air. You may be wondering, by the way, what the Revolting Theater does. And in a few minutes on Fresh Air, Lani and Thule will be performing some excerpts that they do in the Revolting Theater show. Thule, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the Fugs before we start talking about the Revolting Theater. How did the group first form?
Well, we were poets reading in at a coffee shop in New York City on 2nd Avenue called Le Metro, after that famous Paris institution. And after the show, after the poetry readings, mine were already a little theatrical. I had found poetry, and I'd act a few of the things out. We'd go around the corner to a place called the Dome, which is a Ukrainian bar. And they had a jukebox there that played Beatles and Rolling Stones songs. And poets don't dance, you know. That's why they're poets. No, it's... Anyway, they don't dance well, but the music was sort of irresistible, or even more irresistible, as I've seen in an advertisement. And they got up and sort of walked around, jumped around like sort of in their elephantine way. And we really got to like the music, and Ed got the idea that it would be good to put our poetry, which was far out anyway. And the new music together, and I picked the name, and there was another leftover Air Force reject named Ken Weaver around, who could sort of play drums on a fruit box, wooden fruit box. You don't see many of them anymore either. And I took the name from Norman Mailer's Naked and the Dead. There's a famous Dorothy Parker anecdote about that. When she met him, she said, "Oh, you're the man who can't spell dot, 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 dot." Anyway, that's how we got our name. We couldn't spell either.
Right. You recorded a lot of songs that could never be played on the radio because you used all the language that you can't use on the radio or on television.
That's right. That language and, oh, jeez.
So I guess you knew right from the start that the airplay potential of your work was going to be limited,
yeah,
and therefore you're going to be reaching a limited audience.
Well, we were actually aiming for television and satellite. We wanted to be beamed by satellite to Moscow. So we didn't worry at the beginning about what kind of an audience we were going to reach. We were used to playing to reading as poets to huge crowds of 10 and 30. And at the beginning, we really had a lot of fun. And that was our main goal. But then we saw there was a potential to reach people. And there are other ways to reach people besides radio. In person. As a matter of fact, our show was, I would say, maybe more than 60% visual and a dramatic thing. We acted out each song. I had dozens of costumes and props, and it was theater, what it really was.
What did fans do when they met you when you were with the Fugs? I would guess that some of your fans would try to outdo you in excess to prove that they could be one of you or be in sympathy
with you. Yeah, well, since we were so crazy, we didn't notice that, in quotes, that our fans were crazy too. But I do remember one in our early tour in San Francisco when there was a deep pit between us and the stage, between the audience and us on the stage, and there were a few bottles thrown, not at us, but just out of incredible joy. One person fell in the pit, which wasn't so funny, and they wrecked a ping pong table, which was also on the stage for some reason or other. But that's the most damage they ever did. I mean, the Beatles fans do more damage than that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, no. We had a very reserved audience, really.
What are the people who were with the Fugs doing now?
Well, Ed is living in Woodstock and writing. I think he's doing, he has various writing projects. He's doing a book on the Eagles, and he's involved with a local power project. They're attempting to start up a water power electricity scheme in that area. And Ken became a zookeeper and worked in a lumber mill, and then he found God. Texas, at least that's what he said. The last time he spoke to me, he told me he had stopped drinking, but I think he was drunk when he told me that. So I haven't heard from him for a while. The musicians have all gone their various ways. Jake and the Family Jewels are going strong. Stephen Grossman is going. Still playing, and one of our bass players married a famous rock singer. She's so famous, I can't remember her name, or the bass players. But there were perhaps 25 or 30 musicians that passed through.
Well, you're doing the Revolting Theater now. What have you done between then and now? What are some of the things you've done?
Oh, I've just
years?
Sort of moped around. no, I've done a lot of. I've written song parodies, and I wrote a novel about vaguely based on Fugs, which was never sold, and I edited some books of photographs of well-known people as children and a collection of their writings as children, and I have four or five unpublishable book manuscripts lying around.
Let's hear a little bit about the Revolting Theater. What's the, how is the group organized? Leonard, let's introduce you into the conversation.
Hi. Well, we, when the Fugs broke up, Tooley and I were friends. I knew Ken Weaver. I was in a service with him, one of the Fugs. So I sort of, I was also an early publicity agent. That's why no one heard of the Fugs in the early days, because I was handling it. But, we felt the same need to get radical information out to people and in a palatable way, as it were. And so we stuck together some old Fug songs, and basically what we do, we're a documentary theater. So we, on the theory that society is funnier than you could make it up. So we take basically like news stories and weird products and things, you know, gross commercialism, and present them as they are. And some of the stuff is pretty funny. Like we have leak-proof holy water fonts that are on sale around the country and various things like that. But basically, we try to get theater, political theater, which really doesn't have a basis in this country. In Europe, cabaret and political theater is like it's a tradition. But in America, political theater really is not, unless it's a time of great turmoil like the Vietnam War or something, it's just somehow Americans become myopic or something, and they're not interested. But we keep plugging away and going from here and there.
How long have you been doing the Revolting Theater?
About 10 or 11 years now.
Can you do an excerpt of some of the things that you do in the show?
Yeah, well, I can do a couple of songs, and maybe Lenny can read the prose pieces. How's that? You do that now?
Sure.
All right. well, we all know that there's been a religious revival in this country, and the vibes are coming in from all directions, not just from the West or the South or the North, but from the East, too. And I wrote this song to sort of celebrate that revival. Swami, how I love you, how I love you, Swami, every Kananda, I'd give my Maya to be among devotees in any PAL, but that my guru is waiting for me, praying for me down by the Ganges. Some freaks out west will glim me no more. When I get to that Irrawaddy shore, oh, Swami, how I love you, how I love you, Swami, every Kananda. I'd walk a million futras for one of your sutras, my Swami. And, moving right along to more, this is the latest song I wrote. Might be the last, I don't know. It's to a Merle Travis mining song. You all remember that. Mm-hmm. Come all you young fellows, so young and so free. Seek not your future in the U.S. Army. It's like a junk habit. It creeps in your soul till the gleam of your mind goes as dark as the coal. It's cramped as a prison and cruel as the gun. The dangers are many and the pleasures are none. where the laughter is bitter and the song's never free. Oh, it's just like a jail in the U.S. Army. They'll tell you enlist, say it's better than the draft. We'll teach you a trade, but killing is their craft. The sergeants will taunt you, the officers smile. Human kindness will leave you after a while. It's cramped as a prison and cruel as the gun. The dangers are many, the pleasures are none. Where the laughter is bitter and the song's never free. Oh, it's just like a jail in the U.S. Army. And you'll become cynic, and you'll be like them, and never remember that folks can be friends. You'll end up a hater, their training will win. Oh, it's better, far better, never to begin. Oh, it's cramped as a prison and cruel as the gun. The dangers are many and the pleasures are none. Where the laughter is bitter and the song's never free. Oh, it's just like a jail in the U.S. Army.
And as I was talking before, we take a lot of the stuff from news stories and actual products, and this is a news poem. And first I'll read the news story that it was based on. This is from the New York Post. The headline goes, Six Psychiatrists Nabbed in Fraud. $131,000 Rip-Off in Medicaid. Chief among those indicted was Dr. S., 66, of 60 Sutton Place South. Dr. S. is noted for her work in detecting signs of approaching delinquency. She has earned worldwide recognition in the field and in 1965 was awarded the National Society for the Prevention of Juvenile Delinquency's Meritorious Achievement Award. Now here are the criteria for detecting signs of approaching adult delinquency. 1. Holds M.D. 2. Diplomat of American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. 3, very important, accepts Medicaid patients. 4, incorporated in non-profit foundation. And 5, of course, enjoys clothes, travel, summer homes, and rare gems. And finally, of course, must be a supporter of the free enterprise system. And now we move along to true professions. This is a salute to the law. Our first salute is by Robert Frost, and he says, a jury consists of 12 persons chosen to decide who has the better lawyer. 2, this is an old Chinese proverb, which says, a piece of paper blown by the wind into a law court may in the end only be drawn out by 2 oxen. A shilling subscription having been set on foot to bury an attorney who had died very poor, Lord Chief Justice Norbury exclaimed, only a shilling to bury an attorney? Here's a guinea. Go and bury 1 in 20 of them. 4 states, a town that can't support 1 lawyer can always support 2. And 5, and that lawyer was right who left all his money to support an asylum for fools and lunatics, saying that from such he got it, and to such he would bequeath it. That was by Jeremy Bentham. And the next is an English one from the late 19th century. Hurrah, hurrah, cried a young lawyer who had succeeded to his father's practice. I've settled that old chancery suit at last. Settled it, cried his astonished parent. Why, I gave you that as an annuity for your life. And 7, in a speech to the National College of District Attorneys in 1971, Maurice Najari compared the thrill of a jury foreman saying guilty to the act of making love. And here's an American one from the 19th century. First, the judge says, "Judge, are you trying to show contempt of court? Defendant, no, I'm trying to conceal it." And Martin Erdman said in 1971, gave this definition for judges, whores who become madams. And now we have another definition, a lawyer, one skilled in circumlocution of the law, Ambrose Bierce. And of course, there's that famous T-shirt slogan, lawyers do it in their briefs. An Irish proverb has, love all men, barring an attorney. And a gypsy curse states, may you have a lawsuit in which you know you are in the right. And Malatesta described this one as organized vengeance called justice. And the Scots have a proverb, take a pint and gree, the law's costly. And here's what Willie Shakespeare had to say about it in Henry VI. The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. And from the 18th century English, the law locks up both the man and woman who steals the goose from off the common, but lets the greater felon loose who steals the common from the goose. And the penalty for laughing in a courtroom is 6 months in jail. And if it were not for this penalty, the jury would never hear the evidence. H.L. Mencken. And Lenny Bruce had this thought. They call it the halls of justice because the only place you get justice is in the halls. And when there's a rift in the loot, the business of the lawyer is to widen a rift and gather the loot. Arthur Garfield Hayes. And from the Bible, Luke 2:46, and we all know that's the word of the Lord. Woe unto ye also, ye lawyers, for ye laid men with burdens grievous to be borne, and ye yourselves touch not the burdens with one of your fingers. And finally, we have a story of Pat and Mike, who are walking by the cemetery one day, and Pat says, I see a grave where two men are buried. And Mike says, now how would that be? He says, well, just look on the gravestone. It says, here lies a lawyer and an honest man.
Okay. We've heard some excerpts of the Revolting Theater. They're the group that you missed last night at the Wooden Shoe. They were brought here by the Wooden Shoe. My guests are Tule Kupferberg and Lanny Canfield, who together are the Revolting Theater. Do you vote in elections?
Yeah, I vote in every election. I seldom vote for anyone that gets elected, but I vote.
Do you vote, Tule?
Well, I sometimes vote, and I have to explain it, because there are good reasons not to vote. In the last election held in the Spanish Republic before the Franco Rebellion, it was discovered that if all the votes for the Republic were counted, about 40% of the anarchists had to have voted. So, supposedly against their principles. So I think it's all right for smart people like you and me and the audience to vote without illusions. See, vote without illusions, knowing that the very next day you will probably have to oppose whoever you voted for. And if the line isn't too long, or if I don't have to go to the grocery that afternoon, I might just drop in.
Would you vote for anyone who's running for president now, Lanny?
Well, I think that this Citizens Party that started up and had that convention in Cleveland last weekend is interesting, more probably as a protest vote against the two major parties. If they get on the ballot, that's probably who I'd vote for.
What about you, Tule?
Well, I might vote. I might not vote. I might vote for them, or I might vote for some other socialist or a libertarian candidate. I think there is a real danger in thinking that the voting means very much. And every time I heard Gore Vidal on the Susskind show, and he At first he said yes, he was going to vote for somebody, and then the next second he changed his mind, sort of. I guess he's as flighty as I am about this. He said he'd like to get it down where, you know, in the last election, I think maybe a little under half of the people voted. He said when it was down, when it would be down to 30%, he thought, then the illusion that those people in Washington, who are they anyway, would, that they had anything to do with or had any mandate at all to destroy the country the way they have been doing so successfully for hundreds of years.
Yeah, during when Nixon won his great landslide victory, that if you figured out actually who voted for Nixon, it was less than 20% of the American people, and that was claimed to be the greatest landslide in history. So it's a little...
Well, it was a mudslide.
Right.
Do you ever get nostalgic for the 1960s or the 1950s?
I like the 1920s.
Uh-huh.
No. Do I get nostalgic? Yeah, except when they were there, of course, there were just as many problems as there are now, if not more. But there was, at least until recently, it was a more lively time to live. You know, the Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. So yes, I'm afraid I have to admit that, yeah.
Lenny, what about you?
Well, during the late 60s, I mean, I consider the 50s to have run up through about 1963 or 4, right? I mean, when you talk about decades, there may be a decade of 64 to 74, something like that as far as... And I figure the late 70s are more like the mid-50s in a lot of ways as far as activity goes. But I thought in the late 60s, really, things were really changing and society was... changing in a lot of fundamental ways, and I guess it really has in sexual mores and certain political ideas, but it's certainly a lot less than I thought was going to happen, right? So I suppose that's a little bit of nostalgia. And of course, in the late 60s, I suppose you could tell what someone thought by how they looked and stuff, and that, of course, is all gone by the boards, right?
I wonder if you think that there will be a big 60s nostalgia boom the way there's been one for the 1950s?
Oh, only if we have a war.
You think so?
Well, I don't think that's the main issue, whether we have a nostalgia boom. The boom is
commercialized.
Is whether we have, the real interesting question is whether we have a politically active, important period where there's social movement and change toward the better. And I think Carter's stupidity plus the depression, American politicians' general stupidity, plus the depression which American radicals have been praying for in a sort of distorted way for... 50 years may actually be coming, and if we're lucky, we'll get some sort of union between the activists, who are mostly young, and the intellectuals around the universities, and the, you know, heart of America, the working class and the middle classes, the lower middle class, or the people who are getting screwed, you know.
What tactics do you think would work now for an acting change and for just sparking a stronger
social movement
than there is now?
Information is power. I mean, I was in the Air Force in 1960 when I got out of school, right? And I went into Air Force Intelligence, and they told me there that information is power. And if you don't want to kill people, that's the only way to go. And being a pacifist, I don't believe in force. So information and spreading the word, and Jefferson said that if people know what's going on, they'll know what to do. So that's just basically anti-censorship. And censorship in the sense that people have access to the media. Now where you have larger and larger media like television and the networks, you notice they've taken off some of the censorship controls from the print media, but nobody reads anymore. So it's really, we're probably in a more censored state today than we were, say, 20 years ago, even though it's not as apparent, because you can say much less on television than you can write in a book. So it's the jury is out. It's both ways. It's a two-edged sword, right?
Well, it's okay to say that information will do it, or this will do it, or that, but you see, if you take it a step further back, you realize that we don't have control of information. And you don't need control of information for a day or a second or one station or one program. And it's a sort of a cyclical problem. If you had control of information, you'd already have control of the heights of power in society. So I think we don't know the techniques to use. If we knew them, we would have used them in the 60s, or they would have succeeded in the 60s. We tried a lot of things. And I think both the anarchist and the Marxist vision, the leftist visions of all kinds, just haven't worked, and we don't really know what to do. If we knew what to do, we'd have had the revolution.
You know, I think one question that everyone in radical politics, and particularly, I guess, people who are in radical theater like yourself, have to eventually ask at some point is your goal to reach the people who agree with you or the people who don't agree with you? And if you want to reach the people who don't agree with you, are you going to scare them by being too revolutionary or too radical or too weird and bizarre? I'm sure you've thought about that.
Yeah,
so what kind of things have you come up with?
It's a dilemma, because if you don't want to water down what you have to say. So basically we say what, you know, what we think is right, and we end up probably to a large extent being sort of a radical USO troop and goes around, and you know, but it's also information that people who may be radical in one area may not know, for instance, all of these things about lawyers, or they may, you know, so it's an educational process, and people wander in every now and then, and you know. But you do what you can. So if you water down things so that everybody listens, a lot of time you end up saying nothing. So
well, if you're a radical, if you're a humorous theater, you can't water it down your humor. You end up like Bob Hope, who I think is one of the least funny people in existence. He studiously avoided saying anything that important for 40 years. And so has a huge audience. But I think there are people who, as Lenny said, wander in. They're just at they've come up to the top of the hill, and they look down, and suddenly you poke your face up, and you just might pick them off. So you can't change your message, because otherwise you don't have any message. Otherwise you're Bob Hope.
You've been, Tuli, you've been active in radical theater and radical forms of poetry and music for, 15, 20 years? More?
No, maybe 40 years.
40 years?
Mm-hmm.
Lenny?
I would say probably about 15 years, something like that.
So, well, for you, there's strong connections between decades, because you've been doing what you're doing for some time, and a lot of times it's the young people who hook into that kind of radical theater, and I wonder what connections you feel young people who have been a part of your audience have made to the radical movements of the past decades you've lived through and been radical through, and ones that they haven't lived through.
Unfortunately, I don't really look back except for the 60s, in which I was very active. The 50s were a really terrible period, and all the radicals I knew just met once a week in a small room on Broadway in New York City and just sort of hung out and tried to encourage each other not to be terrified. And the 40s, I guess I was, and the 40s, the war took care of most of that, and I guess I don't really remember too much of the 30s. There is a vast discontinuity, I think, you were mentioning it, and young people always feel, and rightly so, that they're discovering all these things for the first time, and they are, in their own lives, and it has the feeling of being new and fresh. And that's good. I don't think there. I don't think there is an absolute need to know everything about the history of the radical movements, since the history of the radical movement is mostly a history of failures. That's why it has a history. As soon as it succeeds, its history will sort of end, and a new kind of history will begin, which I don't know if it will be called radical or what. But it's a function of the people who were there before, of course, to point out what mistakes were made and try to have the newer people not make the same mistakes, and have themselves not make the same mistakes or go down the same blind alleys. And
what are some
my
mistakes?
Only advice to a young person would be that he should actually look to the past. I think it's a funny thing, actually. Santayana said those who have not read history, do not know history, are condemned to repeat it. But you could just as well say, I think, those who have not, who do not understand, who have not read history, are not condemned to repeat it, because you somehow tend to do what's been done before if you know about it, and maybe what's been done before is not always what you should do now.
I think the young people today that are into radical movement or radical ideas are serious about it, in the sense that they know what they're doing and they're thinking about it. Similar in my own experience to like the mid-60s, when there weren't 9 million people in a demonstration. You know, when I first went to a demonstration, there was like 20 people. But within 2 or 3 years, there was like hundreds of thousands of people. And those, when it was really popular, well, a lot of it was due to it being the thing to do. And that's probably part of the reason why a lot of it died out. Of course, what do you do for an encore once you get 1 million people in Washington anyway? That was one reason why, you know, it didn't grow beyond that. But I think people nowadays know a little more. They're a little more sophisticated than the way it was, say, in the late 60s, early 70s, when it was so popular, right?
You both want to see dramatic change happen in this country. Do you have a vision for what you'd like to see the country turn into?
Get rid of money first.
Well, it is true. It's mostly like a series of negative things. You know, the things are certain things are terrible, and you want to eliminate them. And then you have a hope that the a human personality, in spite of some negative things that may exist, it can really create its own utopias, which don't all have to be the same, but should all be non-violent and non-interfering and bring as much happiness as possible to individuals.
Tula, you have 3 kids, and I'm just curious what they do and how they think, you know, if they're politically similar to you, if any of them are very straight by comparison.
Well, there's my oldest son, who's 30, is a radical and has taken part in a lot of radical activities. My younger children are 10 and 6. I think there's a danger that I've seen. I have a collection called "And a Little Child Shall Bleed Them," and it consists of photographs of little children with guns. Some of them are. A lot of them are fascists, some of them are communists, and there might be even some anarchists. Anyway, it's a uniformly disgusting collection. So I think what you have to watch out for is, it's inevitable that the children are going to accept the major theses of their parents in the main, and ideas about life and what's right and what's right politically. But I think you have to, you should sort of lean backwards a little, not to impose your frame of political reference on the kids. So they have a tendency then to be a little naive about anything. They don't really have a lot of ideas about politics and society. And I except when it comes up specifically. For instance, they want to sell things in the street, and that's very a problem to me. I don't like to buy and sell things. So I sometimes let them, and if they do, I want, insist that they don't try to cheat anyone. Or I ask them why they think it's worth this much. You know, they should never charge more than they've paid for it, and so on. It's quite a complicated problem, the question of the ideology of your children. But I think it should best, now that I think about it, it has to be best done in a practical, day-to-day, on a need-to-know basis, and not... In other words, you shouldn't hand your kid the Communist Manifesto when he just learns how to read, so he's going to grow up to be a good communist. I think he may be a good communist, but he'll also be a stupid person, because he'll never have had the chance to work it out a little bit more for himself or herself.
I'd like to just end by asking you both briefly what you think's ahead for the 80s, if you have any intuitive sense of that.
Well, I would like to think that things are picking up in a sense, but I suppose if the economy goes worse, empty stomachs make for discontent, in a real sense. The late 70s were, like I was talking earlier, like the 50s or something, right? But I see things picking up a little bit as far as activism and changes and things like that happening.
Well, I'd like to agree with Lanny, but I have a reservation about... I do agree with him, but there's also the eye for insanity factor. It emanates out of Washington and Moscow and whatever, the sources of power in our society. And I think if there's something you really want to do, maybe you shouldn't wait too long, because we really don't know what we're... I don't know what we're headed into. It may be some kind of world apocalypse.
Dissatisfaction could result in a Hitler-like state as easily as it could.
Well,
another,
I'm talking about atomic war, too.
We won't have to worry.
If Carter feels... if Carter really falls behind in the polls, who knows,
Well, an enthusiastic note to end on. Listen, I want to thank you both for being here. We're out of time. Is there a chance that you'll be back in Philly and that people who missed your performance last night will get another chance to see you in the near future?
Well,
you don't know.
we never know. Okay. We'll never know. Do one.
Okay, well...
Write this station if you want us to perform.
I wish you both the best. I thank you a lot for being here. I appreciate
Thanks.
Your making the trip to Fresh
a pleasure.
Air. I've been with Tuli Kupferberg and Lannis Canfield, and together they comprise the Revolting Theater, which performed in Philadelphia last night. They were brought here by the Wooden Shoe. You may remember Tuli also from the group The Fugs that was recording during the 1960s, and Lanny tells me that he was doing publicity for The Fugs at that time, and as he put it, that's why... In the beginning, not many people knew about them. Well, let's listen to another selection from one of the Fugs records, and we'll only listen to part of this because it gets the language gets a little questionable towards the end of this for radio, so we've got, I'd say, about a half or two-thirds of it to get through safely. This is called Nothing, and it's a piece that was written by Tuli Kupferberg.
Take for a novena, a garnish, giggle, a job as white, a garnished. Lunes, nada, martes, nada, mia. chocolate y puedes nada. Vienes por cambio un poco más nada. Sábado otra vez.
Nada.
Okay, we're going to get out of this song while it's still safe before the four-letter words come rolling around. That was a recording by the Fugs made in the mid-1960s called Nothing, written by Thule Kupferberg, who was just my guest on Fresh Air. In a couple of minutes, Bill Van Wert, our film reviewer, will be with us, and he's going to review the new film Foxes, which stars Jodie Foster, and he'll also talk about this week's Academy Awards. And then at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Barbara Meyerhoff, who's an anthropologist who's been studying a senior citizen center in Venice, California. You may have seen her movie, which was called Number Our Days, which was about this senior center. It won an Academy Award in 1977 as Best Documentary. We'll open up the phones when she joins us at about 4 o'clock. This is a selection from the new Dollar Brand record. It's called African Marketplace.
Thank you.
We're listening to the title track from a new Dollar Brand record called African Marketplace. We've gotten a lot of calls about that record, so I'll just say the... Given it's Dollar Brand, is also called Abdullah Ibrahim. The album's called African Marketplace. It's 21 minutes to 4 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Barbara Meyerhoff will be with us shortly after 4 o'clock to talk about her research into a senior citizen's home in Venice, California. You may have seen her movie or read her book. Both are called Number Our Days. Every Friday at about this time, Fresh Air's film reviewer Bill Van Wert joins us to review new movies and to highlight movies on television. This week we get another extra special addition to Bill's feature. He's also going to give us his impression of the Academy Awards. But we'll start with the film The Foxes, which I think just opened, starring Jodie Foster. What'd you think of it?
Started today. I'm being slightly facetious now. It's a little bit of an update on Little Darlings. It takes the other side of the spectrum. We're instead of two young girls, we have four young women. And instead of their worrying about teenager status to come, as they did in Little Darlings, here the four women have done it all. One hasn't. And it's ironic that she, the only virgin in the film, gets married at the end. She conforms the way that all the parents in the film want the other women to do. It's a very strange film for me, and I think that some of it has to do with my owning up to a bias, which I'll get to in a minute. And I think maybe I can let people understand how we come to films with a bias based on our age or our own experience, if a film gives us a particular slice of life on the spectrum. I thought it very strange in the final credits that the producers wished to thank someone named Peter Hollywood. And I think this is a makeup name. I can't imagine anyone having a name like that. I watched the credits, and I noticed a lot of credits going to Janice Ian, three songs, Donna Summer, a couple songs, Bob Seger, Cher, Munich Machine, some other groups I didn't even had never heard of before. And I think that it functions, the music, as a point of departure for me, because it plays as a barometer of the angst of these four high school teenagers. They're all 15, going on 16. They've all had problems with their families. The film is careful to point out that the society, if you're looking for a wrong, goes back to the parents. No parents are healthy in the film. All kinds of broken homes. Within the parameters, then, of the parents are screwy and we're in L.A., which is a mess to begin with. Lots of shots of the porn district and North Hollywood and weird people and weird dogs dressed up and so forth. Within that context, then, we're asked to look at four young women who try to varying degrees to get out of their boxes, to get out of the constraints of their lives. They're constantly talking about going to New York or setting up a boutique or getting away. At the end of the film, they're talking, perhaps more realistically, maybe not, of getting married or of going to college. These things seem to become the escape. I'm not going to give away the plot of the film, but a lot of it has to do with polarities, decisions whether to take drugs or not. Everybody seems to be doing every kind of drug in the film, Quaaludes and hallucinogens of all kinds. At one point, it's a decision whether to stop taking drugs or not. There's a flap in the film between the hoods in the school and the nice boys. And except for the four women who are our foxes, and the marquee says they dared to do it all, I don't understand what that means. I think it's a false come on, because on the one hand, they've done it all and are looking for something else. On the other hand, they are just too scared to get out of their situation, so they haven't done it all. The men in the film are very stereotyped, and, you know, it's... You know, if that's a true or authentic cross-section of what high school is like, then it's a sad state. But I think that a lot of the emphasis falls upon Jodie Foster in the lead role.
She was terrific, I thought, in Taxi Driver. How is she in this movie?
She's excellent in this film also, and that's how I would tie her in with the music. Donna Summer's On the Radio plays, and it becomes a kind of leitmotif for the rest of the music of the film. Periodically, you hear songs on the radio that are supposed to comment on their situation. After you hear Donna Summers actually sing on the radio, roughly at the 2/3 point of the film, then slow guitars play the theme on the radio throughout the rest of the film.
Oh, God.
So it gets serious, okay? Jodie Foster is asked to be our adult, young woman turned adult, and the other women accuse her of that. We don't need another mother. But she's asked to mother the other three, and she's asked to be the voice of college. At one point, she loses her cool and gets very angry at one of the other women and gives her a speech about, well, this is life and life is tough and you're going to do it this way and grow up. And she carries it off, but the film doesn't. She's excellent, and I think for a film like this, she needs to be a lot less excellent. What was real for me in the film were not the scenes of high school or racing with the cars or skateboards or, you know, all of the American Graffiti kind of things that can go on. What was real for me were the scenes involving Jodie Foster and Sally Kellerman, who plays her mother. And the one scene involving Jodie Foster and her father, I don't know the name of the actor who plays the role. They're separated, the parents. She sees her father once in the film. He's involved with rock concerts, and he's coming through town with a rock concert. He takes her in the men's room, and he creates a fantasy for her of building a ranch for her someday with horses and friends around and stability in the family. And it's a very touching scene. And the scenes with the mother as well. Sally Kellerman plays the role of a very neurotic 40-year-old mother who's studying exams on Plato and trying to start affairs anywhere she can and very worried about her changing body and extremely hypersensitive about Jodie Foster and her friends, the high school friends. But they have some beautiful scenes together where they curl up in bed and Jodie Foster reads Plato for her mother when her mother's freaked out. And those are the scenes that stick for me, and they don't seem to have any place in with the rest of the film, which is highly superficial, I think. Another way to look at it, and here's my bias, is I don't know. If you are a teenager looking at this film, perhaps just those scenes between Jodie Foster and her mother or Jodie Foster and her father become the superficial scenes, become the things that aren't true in your experience. But for me, those are the only breakthrough moments in the film where something is said beyond the predictable, what you'd expect to be going on in high school. And I'm not sure what the targeted audience is then. Probably it's a mixed bag, as I've presented it. Probably those scenes at the rock concert, which don't push the narrative any further at all, are there for a teenage audience. And in a sense, people in the audience are teenagers, are asked to watch their peer group suffer. Because there are no joys for teenagers in this film. Everyone is really looped out, losing boyfriends right and left. Nothing works.
How does Jodie Foster look in the film? Does she look different than a taxi driver?
She does. She looks like an older teenager, not hip at all. And the other three are, in varying degrees, very appropriate to the film. I mean, they look like there was some research done in the casting. And they are silly appropriately. Whereas Jodie Foster, I think, looks too wise for the part. She really, when she talks, there's an authority behind her voice that makes me feel that this is the wrong vehicle for her. Clearly someone with that kind of face, and dressed as chic, as properly as she is, and with that kind of authority to her presence, really would get out of teenage angst. you know, and do what she says she's going to do all along in the film. The psychic trade-offs are that she's asked to mother, where all the other mothers fall through. So she really is mothering the whole high school. And it's a strange film that way.
Okay, well, the film is The Foxes, and it opened today, and it stars Jodie Foster. Well, probably a lot of people were watching and listening Monday night when the annual Academy Awards were handed out. What were your impressions, Bill?
Well, I can't say I was surprised, and I don't think anyone was. There was a lot of pre-publicity about who would win and why. I'm not sure all the whys got covered, and I guess I'd like to mention a couple of those. Dustin Hoffman, it should be pointed out, and he said so in his acceptance speech, had always said that the Academy Awards were silly. For the first time this year, he actively campaigned. He lobbied for getting one. And people...
How do you do that?
People who are in the Academy are older, established actors, and each year they elect new actors. So the Charlton Hestons and Gregory Pecks, these are people who are officers in the Academy. How you do it, then, is to let those people know at parties that you're serious about it this time. That, you know, you don't know if you have a chance of winning, but you'd really like to, et cetera, et cetera. How one wins, especially with a film like Kramer versus Kramer, I'm not putting down Dustin Hoffman's talent at all, but I'll stick by what I said when I originally reviewed Kramer versus Kramer, which is that his range of emotions is very limited, and he got an excellent vehicle. The film itself really was an Academy Award setup. That part itself didn't really have much to play. The two people who stole my heart in Kramer versus Kramer were Justin Henry, who got nothing, and Jane Alexander, who got nothing. Meryl Streep's part seems to have completed the marriage that could never be in Kramer versus Kramer, but they gave it to them in the awards, when in fact her role seemed to me very predictable. But the character of Jane Alexander, Margaret, the neighbor, who was friend to both and caught in the squeeze, a mother herself and one who let her husband back, seemed to me a very poignant role and a radically new one for Hollywood. So I think that Hoffman is being awarded here something that people should realize is not just Kramer versus Kramer, but his past performances, since he'd been nominated and had not won. So chalk that up as an award for Midnight Cowboy and The Graduate and so forth. I think that people should realize that since Coming Home won last year, it set up a couple consequences. One was that Jane Fonda would not win for China Syndrome, and Jack Lemmon would not win for China Syndrome, which I think is a real shame. I think he gave the performance of his career in that film.
How does Coming Home affect Jack Lemmon?
As an avalanche effect, as a carryover. But China Syndrome is a special case, which I'll mention in a minute. The other consequence I wanted to mention was that since Coming Home was peripherally, related to Vietnam, that Apocalypse Now could not win. And I think it probably suits everyone's stomachs in the conservative academy to do it that way. One doesn't want to reward films with all of the backlog of horror stories and over-expenditures and so on that Coppola got with Apocalypse Now. By the same token, I think that a lot of the film studios now are part of conglomerates with electrical corporations. Paramount, for example, is a Gulf and Western company. These corporations are into energy, and there is no way that the China Syndrome, which attacks nuclear power, will ever become Best Picture. That would have been the surprise for me if that film had gotten any recognition. I think that Melvin Douglas was probably right when he refused to attend, saying that the awards for him were really ridiculous because they pitted him against a child, Justin Henry. And I think that the Academy awards people on the ends of their careers. So there probably was some thinking that Douglas should be rewarded, whereas a Justin Henry, that young, will have plenty more time to get awards. I think also that people should realize that Bob Fosse winning the minor awards for All That Jazz is a kind of stalling technique. If in the next year or so he comes out with another half as excellent a film as All That Jazz, he will win. And I think that Robert Benton won, I would say, not to my taste, with Kramer versus Kramer. I think that I would have given it to, I mean, the best films that I reviewed this past year, for example, and we reviewed everything that was up. My favorites, not just personally, but in terms of what they did for film, in terms of technique and social commentary, how they moved audiences, I think were All That Jazz, for the radical merger, I think, of serious content with the musical form. And they did steal awards away from Star Trek. If All That Jazz had not existed, Star Trek would have won a lot more awards. Apocalypse Now, I would have considered seriously for Best Picture, although it's not a picture that will give any other awards. The characters are much less important in a film like that. And Northern Lights, which got mentioned for nothing.
Didn't get anything.
And that says a lot about, you know, that Hollywood is really, it's a fascinating phenomenon. It's like the MVP in sports. It's Hollywood is really protecting its own industry, but choosing the format of its rival. It's a TV spectacular. And television is the rival of film.